Lynn Vavreck is the Marvin Hoffenberg Professor of Political Science at UCLA. Last year, she published The Bitter End, which is an analysis of the 2022 election, looking for developments that will endure and shape the future. This is the second part of my interview with her, in which we jumped into a discussion of those results and how they bear on the 2024 election. Vavreck's view of what was the most significant result of the 2022 election took me completely by surprise. We led off discussing her description of American politics as calcified, rigid, and yet with unprecedented consequences because the two parties have become so far apart. Let's jump into it. We just had this important election in 2022. It surprised a whole bunch of folks. There's good reason to believe one of the most surprised people in the country was Kevin McCarthy, who did not get a nice 30-vote margin for his majority. What's your view of calcification in the 2022 election?
I think when we look at the midterm elections in 2022, we see a lot of that same rigidity we talked about a moment ago at the state and county level. So district by district, there was less volatility than there has been in the past, meaning that the vote within district looked a lot like it looked in the last election. Less volatility. And that is about calcification. I also think that you saw instances where the candidates really mattered. And so that's important too. When you talk about these elections getting closer and closer and the things that are determining outcomes, there are some really nice examples in 2022 where the candidates really made a difference. And so I would point to both of those things as key moments that illustrate some of the things we're talking about in The Bitter End.
And independents in 2022?
I haven't looked a lot at independent voters and what they did district by district. But I suspect that, as you say, they're sort of always predominantly with the winner.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I haven't seen a breakout of independents in the big crucial contest nationally. The figures I've heard is that the Republican turnout was about 3% over the Democratic turnout nationally, but independents broke for Democrats by somewhere between 2 and 3%. So they're in the mix, definitely. The split tickets in 2022 were dramatic. You had instances where voters in Georgia went to the polls as registered Republicans, promptly voted for Kemp for governor, and then went down the line to figure out who they were going to vote for senator, and either didn't vote for the Republican candidate, Herschel Walker, or ended up voting for Raphael Warnock. A true split-ticket situation. I haven't seen a completely reliable breakout of how large that might be, but the raw numbers of the Warnock vote, the Walker vote, the Kemp vote indicate there were a lot of Republicans who did something a lot like what I just laid out. So that's a split ticket behavior going on in a way that matters a great deal. Warnock was elected, and as someone pointed out, it was the first time in history every incumbent won. Any thoughts on your end about how split tickets play a role in this?
This story, what I like about it is, again, going back to the importance of candidates and campaigns. It's just a great illustration that voters are not blind. They are not just voting party. And here's an example where partisans decided to defect from their party to do what they thought was best for the common good. And you'll hear a lot of people saying that doesn't happen. Voters aren't equipped to do that. And I just think that these examples that you've pointed to, especially this Georgia one, are really good examples of voters doing exactly that. So obviously, yes, the split ticketing is important, but not just because it's split ticketing and it's something to do. It's important because of what it tells us about the way voters are paying attention in these contests and to these contests and what they value.
And I mean, it's impossible to discuss the Georgia situation without starting to express my personal points of view. It's very hard to, how do you grapple with that? But the case to a Republican voter would have been pretty darn difficult to make about voting against against the Republican candidate. The shift of power within the Senate was abrupt and important. And I think increasingly, you know, you've talked about how the changes as calcification moves forward. I think voters more and more realize their election is nationalized. They are voting for an individual person, but very much they're voting to select who's going to control the body into which this candidate goes.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting. And I think that I hope people will do some good work on this to try to figure out how much that is weighing on voters' minds, as opposed to lots of other plausible explanations that would also lead us to straight ticket voting. It's tricky to sort this out because there are so many reasons, you know, real, legitimate, solid reasons why people might always be voting for the same party. So, but certainly in a case like Georgia, the one that we've been talking about, you could believe that people are going to put a Republican in the Senate, no matter who that person is, because they know the Senate is close. And they know that how important it is to have control of, you know, a branch of the legislative chamber, if not two. And so in that circumstance, you could believe that it's plausible people had that in mind. But we don't really know if that's what people are thinking about. It's an open question, I think, and a very interesting one, how much the average voter has in mind the national political landscape when they're voting in their local election.
So let me wade into a different kind of a question along these lines. And I guess it came up in my mind because so many of the contests in 2022, the big senatorial contests in particular, were between Donald Trump-supported candidates and a candidate who a Democratic candidate who worked very hard to position themselves as some kind of a moderate. I'm thinking of, once again, I'm talking a lot about Raphael Warnock. But I keep thinking about the important, his campaign people talked about the importance that they presented Raphael Warnock truly as a pastor, not a radical advocate. So you had a pastor running against a MAGA-endorsed Donald Trump Republican to create a strong cleavage there. Do moderates do better in general?
Yes, really great question. And there's a bit of mixed evidence on this, but I think for a long time, the answer to that was yes. Moderate candidates, especially if we're thinking about something like the U.S. Congress, tended to do better than extreme ideological candidates in places where both of those candidates were viable in getting the nomination. So if you had a district where either one, an extreme candidate or a moderate, could have won the nomination, the moderate will tend to do better in the general election. And a lot of that comes from the fact that if the extreme candidate had won the nomination, they tend to really light up and mobilize the opposition. So the moderate candidate will do that less. So it's a little bit of a different finding than I think people expect. People think, oh, the moderate candidate just appeals to more people. Well, that's true. But the way that's sort of manifesting itself in the evidence is that that extreme candidate is mobilizing the opposition a lot more than the moderate in the general election. But people have continued to look into this. And in local races, city council, state legislatures, those kinds of races, they're not finding these differences. So I would say that there's a lot of reasons to think that that's true. Moderates tend to do better in general elections when both an extremist and a moderate are viable to get the nomination. But that effect may be waning.
So there was one aspect of the 2022 elections that struck me, and that was, as I was just saying, we had a host of candidates who swore fealty to Donald Trump, declared that the 2020 election was a fraud, and signed on to the full Trump agenda, and did not do very well. But what was also striking was almost all of them, not all, but almost all of those candidates who lost their elections didn't deny the results of the election. It varied from person to person. Some came right out and made the traditional concession speech. Others said various reluctant things. And one candidate challenged the elections repeatedly in the legal system and lost. But there was no January 6th attempt. It's sort of unfashionable to have hope in these days. But I look at that and I wonder, does it mean that the fever is breaking?
I think it's hugely important. I don't know if it means the fever is breaking, but it does mean that democracy did not take one more step toward crumbling institutions. So I think it's very important. In fact, I think it's the most important thing that happened on election night in 2022. Imagine the world that we'd be living in if those candidates who lost said, march on the state house, march on the Capitol, bang down the door, take back the, you know, we'd really be in a very different place. And, I think it is hugely important that we saw basically none of that. And there was no traction for it. There was no calling for it. It wasn't difficult for these candidates not to do it. They behaved like the expectation of a candidate. Most of them conceded the election. None of them called on their supporters to take up arms. I don't know if it means the fever's breaking. I think of the fever as being all wrapped up in the calcification. The stakes of elections seem very high to people because the worlds that the Democrats and Republicans want to build are very different from one another. And voters, in 2022, they know what kind of world they want to live in on those top five or six things that we're talking about. So a little bit of quote unquote the fever, I think, comes from that. And I don't see that going away.
How do you place moderates in that formulation? I really do agree with you. The two parties are very distinct. They have very well defined points of view. They are ideologically consistent in a way that never existed before. We can think back to the time when the American, what is the name of your association? The American Association of Political Scientists denounced the ideological inconsistency of American
right.
voters. Well, that's gone. Now we have consistency of the parties,
yes.
at any rate. So it is absolutely true. Folks can imagine what the world will be or would be if this person gets in office. But for moderates, as you were sort of wading in, it's a bit different. Position on abortion may be one way. Position on the government's deficit may be another way. And there may be identity issues on which there are other things. So it's not, for a moderate, is it about the world or is it a different kind of thought process?
The way I think about this, it's always about the world you want to live in. So, and remember that most people have liberal and conservative positions on issues. Very few people are all liberal or all conservative. So the question is on the five or six things that candidates are fighting about in this election. Do you have a mix of positions or all? Do you want to build a wall on the southern border? Do you want to impeach Donald Trump? Do you want to allow Dreamers to become citizens, separate children from their families at the border? Do you want to allow religious bans on entry into the country? Those, you know, do you think abortion should be legal? Those five or six things were the most important things to people when they thought about 2020 and the world they wanted to live in. And on that set of things, those person-based issues, people really do tend to fall one way or the other. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have, if they take the liberal position on those issues, many of which are related, building the wall, Dreamers becoming citizens, those are related. So like, yeah, they're going to have liberal positions on all those things. That doesn't mean that they don't have a position on raising taxes or the Green New Deal or trade that is counter to the Democratic Party. They might, but we're not talking about those things. We're not fighting about those things. So for a quote unquote moderate, someone who maybe even has half liberal and half conservative positions, what really matters is what are your positions on the top five or six things that we're fighting over right now? Now, if someone really did want to build a wall, think abortion should always be legal, think Dreamers should become citizens, but want a Muslim, like that's an unusual collection. And yeah, for that person, you know, maybe they're going to have to decide based on candidate characteristics or which one of those things is the most important to them. But I don't think fundamentally it makes the decision untenable for them. Maybe they just reduce it to the top two things or the top three things.
Let me make a confession about a personal fear I have about the views of polarization and calcification. And my fear is that it says that the country is becoming ungovernable, that there is no reliable prospect that let's just talk about the worlds. I really like your description, your use of the word world to yeah. encompass things. It really does resonate and it makes sense. And the ideological consistency flows into that. So I'm a voter. I'd love to vote for my party's candidate. I would love for my candidate to win this year. I know that it isn't going to happen overnight. We're in this calcified political situation in which we've seen the presidency exchange hands with volatility and with the policies shifting 180 degrees very rapidly. I don't think there's an American who believes that if one bill is passed by one president, it will stay intact and will govern our society for the next generation. The fear then is that we become ungovernable because our politics is volatile, endlessly changing, and as you're pointing out, endlessly changing on the whims of very few voters who are making the crucial differences. So I just sort of have to get that off my chest. I'm not a political scientist. I try to be objective about these issues, but I'm not. I, like a lot of American citizens, I care a whole heck of a lot about what's going on. And that is one of my real fears. In your theories or mm-hmm. in your descriptions, is there room for hope?
tell me what you mean by ungovernable.
What I mean is that the presidents have been able to have a program, been able to have a unified government where they can implement a program for about the first 2 years of their presidencies. And then, like Joe Biden, they lose their majority in one or another house. They become a president who issues press releases, tinkers with executive orders around the fringes, and that's it. Maybe in the next election, they could be reelected. They could have a unified government and once again return to the governance program that was part of their original vision of the world they could create. That it's very specific and it's very real. It is the loss of power abruptly, the inability to think back to things like the Roosevelt era, where we had a president who would initiate programs, build on them, reject ones that don't work, put in new ones over and over and over again, over a decade's period. I don't want a president back for a decade, but that's what I mean by the volatility of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think, yes, I think there's reason to be somewhat optimistic, but one of the things that I think about when you think about this gridlock, which is, I think, part of what you're talking about, like paralysis to get things done, is the difference between New Deal issues and identity-inflected issues in terms of what's possible with bargain and compromise. So one of the things you hear people say is like the art of politics is fading from politics. And what they mean is that the ability to bargain and compromise to move policy a little bit, maybe not as far as you want, but a little bit, like that's going away. And part of what I think is challenging about doing that in an era where the things we're fighting over are these identity-based issues is, let's take building a wall on the southern border. That's a lot different than what should the tax rate be on small businesses. So we're either going to build the wall or we're not. We're going to build a wall, but instead of it being 8 feet, it's only going to be 4 feet, right? There's no, oh, we're going to build a wall, but only on these 200 miles, not the, you know, it's an all or nothing. There's no policy in the middle that makes any sense compared to what should the tax rate be on, you know, people earning above $200,000 a year. That's a continuum. And you could see people bargain. You want it to be this. I want it to be this other thing. Let's meet in the middle. Okay. I can live with that. You can live with that. And it's a sensible policy position. But these identity inflected things, they don't have a middle. Should same-sex couples be allowed to be legally married or not? There's no, oh, let's let them be legally married on Mondays and Tuesdays, but not Wednesdays and Thursdays, right? It's not sensible. And so that is part of the reason that it seems like the art of bargaining and compromising isn't important to people. It's not something they want to do. It's not so much that. It's just these set of issues make it very difficult to engage in that kind of art. But it's not going to be this way forever, probably. So to answer your question about, you know, is there room for optimism? You know, like we did fight over the New Deal issues for decades and decades, and we might be fighting over these identity issues for decades and decades. There are more to come. Immigration and abortion seem very central right now, but gender politics and gender identity politics and bathrooms and sports teams, and I think all of that is yet to come from a policy perspective. And so we've got a lot more of this to get through. Maybe it's going to be decades, but maybe something else will come along and dislodge these identity issues as the core battle that we're fighting over. It isn't easy to think of what that thing could be. War in Europe between Russia and other countries, possibly. Nobody's hoping for that. That's not very optimistic. So, you know, the best I can do is that these are very tough issues. public opinion really continues to change, that could be one way that it is not so contentious. But I don't think, you know, things change and this will change too. It's just hard to know when that will happen.
Well, let me offer one thought, and I really like your way of phrasing that the identity issues, such as the border wall, simply are not compromisable issues. You're either for it or against it. But if you step back from the border wall and just look at the whole immigration situation, or on abortion, if you step back from some particular proposal and look at the whole question of rights, then I think you can find areas, and this is a way you could move away from the uncompromisable nature of things. You could look for issues within immigration that are subject to compromise. How many folks come across the border legally? Under what circumstances? How aggressive will we be about encouraging the immigration of folks into the United States who we think deserve it because they are refugees or because they have engineering degrees? Those are, so here you are, you're talking about immigration. You've adopted Donald Trump's general issue, but you've moved it into a realm that, as you were saying, is negotiable. You can start seeing conservative Republicans making productive proposals along those lines, and you could start seeing Democrats engaging on those. On abortion, the fact that Roe v. Wade, the national law, is gone, we're now seeing states, one by one, fight enormously over the details of what is going to happen. But in a number of places, that struggle, that political struggle, has not been over banning abortions completely or opening the door wide with no restrictions whatsoever. State after state is saying, here's how we want to approach it. So I would throw out as a, this isn't one policy or one issue or one program. It's a way of approaching all of the policies that could be more productive. Don't get sucked into the identity politics that is attached to one particular way of phrasing it and can be exploited by a guy like Donald.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's where political leadership and political entrepreneurs are really important. How will we package this set of policies? You know, how will we frame the choice for people? And in a world where there's partisan balance in the electorate and elections are turning on very few votes, I think the incentive is there for candidates to try to draw pretty distinct lines between them. And, you know, one of the surest ways to make an issue not salient in an election campaign is to have both candidates agree on the position. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately with the classified documents. So now we've got classified documents appearing on the Republican and the Democratic side of the aisle outside of the White House. Everyone is worried about what does this mean for 2024? And my initial thought was, no sure way to make this not be a concern in 2024 than to have both sides have the same problem or position on this.
And a really terrific position would be silence.
Well, this is what this is my prediction. Who is going to want to talk about this? Not the people on the right, not the people on the left. So so the flip of that is that if you want to have something, if something is going to emerge as a salient feature of a campaign, you have to believe you're on the side that most voters are on, right? You have to have benefit from your position. And you have to know that your opponent is stuck in an unpopular other position. If you don't know that, they can come take the same position as you and they can split the votes with you. So candidates tend to talk about things in campaigns where they feel like they're advantaged and their opponent is far from them. And so that is why you get things like build a wall. It's very easy to distinguish yourself. And 100% Trump knows that the Democrat is not going to come out and say, well, yes, let's talk about where we're going to build that wall. 100% knows that. So it's a for sure, he thinks he's closer to most voters on this. And so he knows that this is going to be a winner for him. This is sort of his thinking. And so that's how you get these kind of hyperbolic black and white issues emerging, and why you don't see more sensible framing of, you know, let's talk about the number of people and let's talk about, you know. So I think the nature of the competition and the closeness of the electorate are playing into that a little bit as well.
One of the most interesting discussions for me in your book was your analysis of how Trump's positions moved the Democratic electorate on immigration issues and on black rights issues. And the observation that was fascinating to me was Trump's over-the-top positions had very little effect on his Republican electorate. They liked it, but not, you know, it didn't shift them in any way on the underlying issue themselves. Democrats, on the other hand, took it as a cue as to what the heck was going on in the real world and moved strongly to a much more liberal position on immigrant rights and a much more liberal position on Black Americans' rights. What's going to happen in 2024, Lynn?
Well, I don't know, Wally. You know, I don't think there's any sign that any of that is slowing down. This is part of the increasing distance between the parties that we were talking about, largely driven by Democrats becoming, on average, more and more liberal on these person-based issues as a party. And so, you know, those gaps are not going away. They're not going to revert to an equilibrium. I think this is a permanent gap on these issues. And so that will be, you know, what does that mean, given what we talked about a moment ago? That means that these issues on which there are big differences between the parties become very ripe fruit to pick for candidates when they want to distinguish between themselves. And, you know, I suspect that many of them will emerge again in 2024. You know, people want to talk about inflation and interest rates and, you know, maybe there will be a bit of that. But I will say that I will be a little bit surprised if the 2024 presidential campaign does not have a component, an identity component to it. I think it will. These issues are, there's too much difference between the party and they're very salient for people.
So we can look forward to CNN and Fox's ratings going up.
I guess.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.